All right. So today is Friday, April 15th, 2011, and this is Lakin Lippman, journalism student at the University of Texas at Austin, and I am interviewing Olympic fencer Dan Cannelon over the phone today in order to record his experiences at the 1968 Olympic Games in Mexico City. So Dan, would you mind giving us some basic biographical information, such as when and where you were born and what your sporting or athletic background was growing up?
Sure. I was born in Cleveland, Ohio, 1945, February 17. And my background is, briefly, is I was a football player at a Catholic school in grade school where we were a championship team and lightweight division. And then in high school, I played tennis at St. Ignatius High School in Cleveland, Ohio. Went, graduated from high school. This was college prep school, and I went to University of Detroit. And that's when I first started fencing. As a freshman, I entered the program as a freshman. And at that time, the NCAA rules were such that you could not compete nationally in the NCAA until you got into the sophomore year, so I had to wait a year, but I was allowed to compete only with other prep schools and high schools and things like that. We couldn't really do any formal NCAA competition. So that's my background, and when I entered college, that was in 1963, in August, September time frame. And 4 years later, I graduated in 67. So that's the brief background.
Mm-hmm. So what was it about fencing that was attractive, that why did you decide to join that team?
It really kind of was, at the time, I liked tennis, but they really didn't have a formal tennis program at the university, so the University of Detroit. So I just felt like I wanted to compete in something. I really enjoyed competing and being in athletics, and so I elected. The fencing program seemed interesting at the time. The coach made a great presentation at the dormitory where I was staying, and I just signed up, and from there it kind of launched me into fencing.
So Tom Lowe told me that you trained with the modern pentathlon team prior to the trials. Were you doing this as well as fencing, and were you planning? I guess you said in the email that you can't compete in two events.
So from college in 1963 through 67, I did compete in the NCAA tournament in Epe in the 1965 tournament as a sophomore, and so I finished ninth in the country, which was a pretty decent result for a first-year fencer. I missed making All-American. I did beat the national champion in a very close bout, which was a featured bout. But I only finished ninth. You have to finish in the top six places. So in 66 and then in 67, I finished as a first-team All-American, finishing third in the national tournament in both years. At the time, just before I graduated, I was in the ROTC program as a second lieutenant. So I was entering the Army and heard about the modern pentathlon program, and I made an application to the modern pentathlon program in the U.S. Army, writing a letter directly to the coach, and was accepted into the modern pentathlon program to train down in Fort Sam Houston, Texas. So after I graduated in 67, I went to the modern pentathlon and started training there as a fencer. And the reason they brought me down there was not because of my modern pentathlon skills, but because fencing is a sport where the pentathletes need to have good competitors. So they brought me in to help the fencing program out, and then I was required to train in the other four sports, pentathlon, which is running, shooting, fencing, horseback riding, and swimming. So those are the five sports. So fencing was my sport. So the other four sports I competed in, but was really never world class because they're very tricky sports, and it's not something you could just waltz into and become good in a matter of time. So I was brought down to help the fencing program.
Gotcha. So Tom also told me that you were a left-handed fencer. So did that, in all of your years of fencing, even before the Olympics, did that give you an advantage?
Yeah, it did. I mean, it's similar to tennis. What happens is in fencing, you have kind of an odd angle to make your hit when you're going against a left-handed fencer. From a righty perspective, the angle is a little bit different. The same thing in tennis. So the sport, because you're doing a different kind of an angle of the hit, the left-hander to a right-hander is more used to that angle because that's really more right-handers than are left-handers. So it's a slight advantage because the left-hander knows how to work the angle of the hit. The arms are locked together in the same parallel path, whereas a left to a right, a right to a right-hander has arms that are across each other. So the angle is a little bit different. So that's the advantage, is that the left-handed fencer is used to fencing that angle. So it's a slight advantage.
Okay. So did you take advantage of that at all during the Olympics or the trials?
Well, there wasn't really anything. The Olympic fencers are world-class fencers,
right,
and so they're used to fencing those angles. So there's a slight advantage, but not a major advantage, because they train and compete against a wide variety of fencers. So it's an advantage, but it's not that much of an advantage.
Okay. So can you recall some training stories from the Olympic trials?
Well, the training stories are, was kind of, are you talking about the actual Olympics or the Olympic trials?
Both would be great.
Well, the training at the Modern Pentathlon Center was just outstanding. I mean, we had we had a couple of people that were from Europe that fenced, and that were really classy fencers. We had a ex-national champion, actually a national champion, Paul Pesty, who was on the Olympics and was also an NCAA champion, who fenced. And so we had probably about six or seven high-quality individuals to fence with. So I would say we as a center had a tremendous advantage over the rest of the U.S. fencers, because we were training constantly with these really classy fencers. So that was a delight. Then in the Olympics, what they did is they had us rotate different countries. So every day, with morning and afternoon sessions, we would go fence the Hungarians one day, we'd fence the Italians the next day, and the Russians. That was really a terrific experience.
Oh, wow.
To be able to fence all these teams in the Olympics up to the actual event. So that was kind of a cool experience. So those are my really memorable experiences.
Do they let other sports do that in the Olympics, like, you know, train with other countries before the actual event?
Well, this sport's unique in the sense that you can't fence, you have to fence with someone else. You can't, it's not a sport that you, like diving where you're jumping into a pool and, you know, you're based on, you have to face off with someone and score a hit on someone. So because of that, that lends itself to training with other countries and other athletes. And so that's the particular nature of the sport.
Was there any particular fencer or certain country you were hoping to face in the games, or one that you trained with before that was your favorite?
Well, of course, the Russian team. The two teams that were really three teams, the Russian team, the Hungarian team, and the Italian teams were really world-class teams. So So I had fenced with a Hungarian who eventually won the Olympics in a Paris event in Europe in 1965, and I fenced a Russian team in 1965 as well in Europe, and so it was really a lot of fun to have those teams fencing either in practice sessions or at the Olympics. So when I fenced in the event, I fenced only the Italian team. I did not fence the Russian team. Someone else fenced against the Russian team. In our event, we were paired with Italy, Russia, and then we had another country. I think it was Czech. I can't remember, but it was just another country that was really not a key player. So we ended up losing both to Italy and to Russia, unfortunately, and then we were knocked out. We never really advanced. It was a very close match against the Italian team. And these teams were world-class teams, and they medaled. Mm-hmm. They had individuals that medaled.
So
that gives you a perspective.
Mm-hmm. Was there any animosity facing Russians, or knowing that you could, or I guess your teammate who did?
I'm sorry, repeat the question again?
Was there any animosity I guess you said you didn't face the Russians, but your teammate did. So was there any talk beforehand of, like, what they might be like because of the Cold War and stuff like that?
No, there wasn't any Cold War stuff. The only thing that really happened was that, and they changed the rules slightly, was fixing. So, in the World Championships, for instance, fencers would fix bouts by predetermining the result. Like, for instance, if it were a close match, and an individual would lose a bout intentionally to advance another player into the finals or to the next round. So there was evidence of that, and what they did in the Olympics is instituted a direct elimination event, which meant that you couldn't really fix anything. If you were eliminated, you were out of a tournament. But what they had is what they call a repechage, so you could be eliminated in a direct elimination and go through a repechage, which is just a way of backing into the finals, going through a second pool where you do where direct elimination. But they used direct elimination, and that eliminated a lot of the so-called cheating that was going on. So that was the only thing that was talked about, but that the Olympic Committee addressed it in fencing, in the fencing federation. Where they did a direct elimination, so people couldn't really throw about. Mm-hmm. But in the World Championships, I saw evidence of that, where a bout would be thrown, and what they would do is they would have the officials sit there and watch the competitors very carefully to see if they could catch them throwing about. And the reason for the throwing of the bout was if you had two fencers that had equal equal losses in a pool, if the score was a close score or a blowout score, a person could advance based on ratios of touches. So they would throw touches or they would throw bouts to allow a country to go up, and then later on that country would pay back another country. And so there was some of that going on. Unfortunately, I didn't see that in the Olympics because of the way they structured the direct elimination, but that was definitely happening in the sport.
Interesting. So what was your favorite fencing move or technique? What set you apart from other fencers?
Probably what I developed for my 3 years that I was at the university was speed. I studied and really worked on my speed, where I had sort of a cat-like movement, where my body and my arm would accelerate very quickly, very rapidly, with quick footwork, and I would hit an opponent before they could do anything. So that was probably my signature hit, where it was speed, and then I also had a speed binding motion, where I would, what I would do is take the blade and ride the person's blade and remove the point from any threatening position on me, and then just thrust it with it, what I call a binding motion, where the blade is sort of pushed aside as I rub the blade and hit the opponent at the same time. So that was my signature move, and that really propelled me into the games.
Was this like a move unique to you, or did you learn this in school?
Well, it was sort of, you know, I mean, every person has a little bit of a characteristic, so it was somewhat unique to me, but it's not something that's not found in the fencing world, but it was one of my characteristics of who I was as a fencer.
Mm-hmm. When did you know you were good enough to make the Olympics? Did your coach at the University of Detroit have anything to do with that?
Well, I had two coaches. I had a coach at the University of Detroit, but I had a Hungarian coach, István Danosi, István Danosi, Danosi. And he was a Wayne State coach, and he was he had fled Hungary in 1956 when they had the issues with the Soviet Union at the time. So he was a great coach, a world-class coach. So he propelled me into it. Really, in 1968, I had a disappointing result in the national championships where I made the finals, which was a major achievement, but I finished ninth in the finals, so my points were low. So what happened is I went into the Olympic trials having to finish in the top three to make the team. So I made the team based on my Olympic trials. I was just very, very, very trained, well-trained, and conditioned through my experience with the pentathlon. So the pentathlon really kind of vaulted me into the Olympics.
Did a lot of your fencing teammates or competitors compete in the modern pentathlon too to help, or was that something that you did on your own?
No, the modern pentathlon, what was kind of interesting about the modern pentathlon is there were, the modern pentathlon had three people, myself, Bob Beck, and Paul Pesty, all made the Olympic team in fencing, and Paul Pesty and Bob Beck also made the pentathlon. So they competed in two events in the Olympics. They competed in modern pentathlon and in fencing. So as I said earlier, we had a really classy set of guys that we trained with. So we all kind of trained with each other and supported each other, and it really vaulted all of us onto the Olympic team to have that quality of the competitors down at Fort Sam Houston.
Who did you beat in the Olympic trials to make the team?
Well, I beat Steve Netburn, who didn't make the team, and who was really somebody who was. Steve did make the team. I did beat Steve. I beat Paul Pesty. I beat a number of really good fencers and finished third. I didn't win the trials, but I finished third. So I had just a terrific day, and I my speed, and as I said, the characteristics of it really, really peaked at the time, where I was really hitting everything I could go for.
Did you work on any running drills to help your speed?
Well, the drills that I did were the running and the pentathlon really prepared me physically for the endurance. Because back in the 1968, we did not have direct elimination. We would do pools all the way to a final. So in today's event, you go generally two pools, so you'd fence for, let's say, an hour and a half with each pool, five bouts. You'd fence 10 bouts, and then you'd get into the you'd go into a direct elimination. That wasn't the way it was back then. It was you fenced as many pools as it was necessary to get into the final. So we'd have a tournament that would start at 8 o'clock in the morning, and sometimes they would end at midnight, and you'd go all day. And so there were quite a few bouts that you had to fend. So endurance was a factor, and so that pentathlon really made a difference. It really made me it improved my endurance because I had to compete in five sports. Even though I wasn't a world class pentathlete, it forced me to run and swim. And so I was very, very well. My physical state was excellent at the time, and that's really why I made the team.
Tom also said that you were in the Army at this time. So what was that experience like while simultaneously training for the Games?
Yeah, I mean, it was a terrific experience. The Army really took care of me in terms of equipment. They bought me a new uniform. They provided me travel expenses. They took the worry out of it. They actually had somebody, a medical doctor that was assigned to us to monitor what we were eating. I mean, it was really, really kind of classy to be part of that modern pentathlon. That was an advantage.
Okay. Okay, and then I know you said it didn't really affect you very much, but the high altitude in Mexico City, this was the first Games with high altitude, so was there anything that you could do to prepare for that, or did it even affect you at all?
It didn't really affect me too much, just because I was in great shape, but, you know, you could feel it when we arrived at the at that altitude in Mexico City. The first day or so, you could feel, you know, you would get a little bit of a burning in your chest. You could feel the effects of altitude, but it really wasn't a major issue. It's not like running, marathon running or something like that. The sport's really like a kind of like a sprint. So, pentathlon team, though, and one of the things is that when I did make the team, I went back to Detroit and got lessons from my coach. My Hungarian coach, but the pentathlon team went on to Colorado Springs and they did high altitude training. So that's one thing they did to get themselves ready for the Games. And I know there were a number of other teams that did the same thing in other sports. They would go to high altitude and they would do the training.
Mm-hmm. So we touched on this a little earlier, but the Games happened at the height of the Cold War. And I know you said at the actual Games you didn't face any of the Russians, but did you meet anybody from the Soviet bloc or get to talk to any of them? And what was your memory of that experience?
Well, it's kind of funny, but, you know, in the Olympics, the memory of the Soviet bloc, you're in kind of a circus environment when you're at the Olympics, because it's kind of an unreal, it's kind of like going to a world fair or something where you have all these international people and, you know, you're in that environment and you're meeting a lot of people in a lot of sports. And so you're not necessarily totally focused on just the fencers. So what I'm saying is that, you know, when you go to a fencing meet, you know, and you're in, like I'm in Europe and I meet the Russians, it's a different experience because you're focused just on the fencing sport and you're talking to the competitors and you have a little bit more airtime with them and you stay at a hotel and maybe they're at the hotel. And you know, I've had instances where I was in Europe and we were invited up to the Russian team, the room that the Russians were, and they had vodka and so on and so forth, and caviar, and you know, so you get to meet these people close up, and in some cases they try to sell you equipment, not in the sight of the KBG, because the KBG really were watching these people to make sure that they wouldn't defect, but But they would take you aside and they would go into some corner and they would go, hey, would you like to buy some blades or some fencing equipment from me? Because U.S. money was worth a lot in Russia. Say you would buy these blades for like one-tenth of the cost that you would pay in the U.S. But for the Russians, it was a big deal because they would get U.S. dollars, they would go home, and they would be able to buy a lot with it. So the experiences at the Olympics wasn't quite that because you dealt with the teams, but you really didn't have that much airtime with them. So it's a different experience. It's like a circus. It's kind of like a World's Fair. There are a lot of people, and you go into these centers, these community centers or whatever, you know, where the athletes all trade pins and you meet people, and it's a worldwide thing. You see a lot of people and you see a lot of athletes and in the training facilities and in the apartments and so on and so forth. So it's just a wonderful experience. It's just a little bit different. It's not so focused on fencing.
So did you witness any sort of trash talking?
No, I didn't really witness any of that trash talking. I mean, that didn't happen. Anything that I could see, you know, there wasn't anything. It was really a wonderful and a wonderful environment. People really, it was a good environment. There wasn't anything like that going on. Not that I could see.
And how was the Russian fencing team? I saw in your answer you mentioned a man by the name of Alexei Nikanchikov, maybe?
Nikanchikov, right. Big guy. There was two people, Gregory Chris that I mentioned, and also Nikanchikov. And Nikanchikov was a fairly tall fencer. Appeared to be very slow, but he had this wonderful hand-eye perception where he could detect just the slightest movements from me and just basically make these unbelievable hits on me where, I got to the point where I was, well, how is he doing this? He was just very accomplished, a world-class fencer, but not particularly fast, but very, 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 very poised and very observant. And you have to fence him quite a bit to really do well with him. Gregory Chris, on the other hand, who ended up finishing second against a Hungarian who won the tournament, the gold medal, he was quick, like me, very fast, and so it was an interesting bout when I fenced him because I threw all my speed at him and he was throwing all his speed, and I was able to penetrate his defense, and he was able to get what we call a double touch, which is a quick counter touch. And within a 25th of a second, it counts as a double hit. So the score was 3-3, and then suddenly the Russian coaches started barking at him. They stopped doing that, you know, because I might beat him. And then he started attacking me, and he ended up winning the bout. But this was a practice bout. But it was what a wonderful experience to fence this guy because it was just a lot of fun. And fortunately, I did not have enough international competition to really know what to do. I mean, you have to really fence overseas a lot more than I did to really do well. And there's some major tournaments in Europe, like Heidenheim. And, there's tournaments in Paris and Germany. These tournaments, you have to fence in those pretty regularly to stay in tune with what's going on internationally, to know what to do. So.
And we touched on a few of these earlier, but the Mexico City Games were marked by quite a few historic moments. The games, the first games at high altitude, the games testing for performance-enhancing drugs, the Black Power Salute, the Soviet bloc, and then that Mexican government massacre of student and civilian protesters. Were you aware of these events while you were there?
Yeah, I was. First, there was a lot of student unrest, and there was a lot of protesting going on. It was just the nature of the time. People were protesting just about anything. So it's kind of interesting that there are a couple of things that I noticed. First, when we got there, we heard about a student riot, and we heard about people getting really injured and so on and so forth. I had, at the time, I did not understand the full extent of it because it was really kind of not reported in the press. It was kind of suppressed. And the government basically didn't want that student unrest, and so they took some gunships, as I later found out, it was October 2nd, I believe, and they hovered over these students and told them to disband, and the students, according to the government was forced to shoot, and these gunships opened up fire, and apparently they shot 40 students. And one of the things that the government said is that we will not have any burials of these kids in this within the city. So they forced the parents to bury their children or to have ceremonies outside of the city because they didn't want to. That was just an amazing story. And unfortunately, I found that out after I had left, but I knew that there was something brewing. That was the first thing. And then the second thing was Mexico really was a poor country, and it was kind of interesting that the Olympics allowed Mexico to do this, but Mexico really struggled to get the games ready, and when we arrived at the airport, they had, at the runway, all the homes were all painted on one side to make it look like everything was really cool there. So they dressed up the area quite well, to make it look really cool, but it was still a very poor country. And when we got to our facilities, the dormitories that they had for us, a lot of them weren't ready yet. They were an unfinished state, and that's kind of the facilities weren't the best. And of course, they had water issues. A lot of athletes got sick from the water. If they weren't careful, we would take pills for that. Because of the quality of the water there, or even if you were to eat salad, you had to be careful because the salad could make you sick. So, for instance, pretty much every member of the basketball team really got sick for the day of the finals, and they competed while they were still sick, and they ended up winning the gold. But it was just kind of interesting that that happened. So. The protests, obviously, were another issue. The protests led into the games, and you saw that with the runners, the athletes, especially in running track and field. My only position on that was I kind of took a very conservative position, whereas it really doesn't have any, there's no place for that in the games. You really shouldn't be doing that, but these people had some black coaches that wanted to make a statement, and they wanted their athletes to make a statement. So there was some information prior to the games that they were going to do this, and they followed through. But some black athletes didn't. George Foreman, as a heavyweight champion, when he beat up the Russian really badly, and I was there at that event, took the American flag, and no power salute from him. He took the American flag and waved it and walked around the boxing ring and got to the cheers of thousands of people that were there. So not all blacks were protesting, just a certain number of them. And again, it was some coaches wanted that to happen, and there were some communications and articles written in Sports Illustrated that some of that would go on, so it was no surprise, but that happened.
Were you at the track meet when Smith and Carlos did the Black Power salute?
No, I don't recall. No, I don't recall that I was there for that black. I don't think I saw that. I saw quite a few events, but I don't believe I saw that.
Had you ever met them before or talked to them before or after this?
It's funny you ask me. I'm sure I met them. I don't know if I got to know them really well, but you pretty much see everybody at the Olympic Center they have there, where you have the lunchrooms and the cafeteria and you're eating with everybody. And, so you hang out with these people. And, you know, you kind of separated the protest from the person. You know, when you're in that setting, it's a wonderful setting. And the protest is one thing, but the setting with the athletes is another thing. And, you know, the protesters go into personal, you know, one-on-one with people.
Mm-hmm.
You don't see that. You just see that in the protest.
Through our interviews for this project, we've discovered that several Olympians have reported receiving a letter prior to the Games from an athlete from Harvard explaining, like, that they wanted to do some sort of human civil rights protest. It kind of foretold a possible protest at the Games and asked for support. Did you know about this? Or, I mean, you mentioned that there was talk about they were going to do something, but you didn't know what, or you didn't get a letter, no one really specifically told you anything?
No, nobody came forward to me on that, so I really had no knowledge of that.
Was there as much talk, well, probably not, but was there as much talk among the white athletes about these kinds of protests as there was black?
No, I mean, the protests, I think, and you say white and black, I mean, there really isn't any major distinction between white and black. It's all a personal thing.
Mm-hmm.
You know, some people agree, some people disagree. So it isn't a black-white thing. It's just basically whether or not you felt protests were appropriate, because there were white people that were in Haight-Ashbury and that were protesting the government involvement in Vietnam and so on and so forth. So, you know, there were people that were that way that were white. So it was a matter of a personal preference. My personal preference was I didn't see any place for it. I was conservative. You know, the Olympics is to be, you know, is to be had in terms of a tremendous experience for competing and meeting people from different countries, and I felt that the protests should not have been part of the Games. I mean, it should not have been introduced. So it's kind of interesting that I think this is, I don't know if I've ever can recall this ever being a protest, you know, like this. But, you know, there were, in Hungary, when the Soviet Union attacked Hungary, you obviously had situations in the past for the Olympics where there was a lot of fervor going into it, where the gymnasts were competing and were outraged at the treatment of the Soviets by attacking into Hungary and, you know, Czechoslovakia and so on and so forth. So you had some of that, you know, where it took the political environment, went in and bled into the Olympics. But for the most part, I didn't, you know, it's a personal thing, and it depends on who you are. It's not a white-black thing, but, you know, there were whites that took their feelings into the Games because there was an invasion by the Soviet Union. So you had that going on, but for the most part, it's just individual preference. So I didn't care for that, but my country wasn't attacked by the Soviet Union, so, you know, if I'd been attacked by the Soviet Union and members of my family had been killed or incarcerated, I might feel differently at the Games and might react differently. So, again, it's personal.
Were any of your friends on the fencing team more liberal in that respect?
Not that I can recall. I mean, I wasn't really focused on that.
Mm-hmm.
I wasn't really focused on who was doing what in terms of that. I was really focused on enjoying it for what it was and enjoying the competition. So I can't say that I was focused. I can't really answer to that.
Okay, so now can you recall the opening ceremonies, waiting around and walking inside, and what it was like?
Yeah, we were staged outside of the stadium, and, you know, my dad actually came in for that, so it was really kind of cool because he was able to meet with me right in the staging area, which is really, probably shouldn't have done that, but he did that, and that was kind of a neat experience. But all the athletes were staged in an environment. So we all walked in. And, you know, it was like being a rock star. You come in and there's thousands of people, you know, screaming and, you know, shouting and blah, blah, blah. And it was just a joyous experience. You know, now the Olympics is much more, even more so of a show than it was back then. But it was pretty rudimentary back in 68. You know, today's events is they have, you know, high-tech shows, and as evidenced by what you saw with the Athens Games and more recently the Chinese Olympics, where, you know, you had some pretty hefty budgets that were spent, and a lot of events and concerts and, you know, dancing and music. And back then it was pretty rudimentary, and it was just all about really what the Olympics was up to that point, how it was celebrated. And so it was pretty traditional, and the doves flying around, you know. I mean, they had mariachis performing and some music, but it was pretty much standard stuff. You know, now it's showtime, and it's huge budget, billions of dollars. You know, security budgets are huge. Not back then, the security wasn't at all what it is today. I mean, what triggered security was obviously 1972, with the attack of the Palestinians inside the Olympic Center, or the housing part. And that, from then budgets are huge now for security. But then, back then, it wasn't that way. It was more. It's probably why you're interviewing me, and what, I mean, this was a kind of a turning point. This was the, you know, protest started, but, you know, it was kind of a turning point where U.S. was so strong, and the Olympics was a different atmosphere, and today it's like totally, totally different.
Mm-hmm. Where were you when those doves were released?
I was in just inside the track. You know, we were all staged by country, just waiting and listening to the openings, you know, opening ceremonies. And, you know, when the runner comes around and he lights the flame, the torch, and the doves are released. And that's kind of how the games was. It would release, and they would circle the stadium, and then they would fly out. So that was more traditional. They didn't fly over me, but I don't know if anybody had an issue. I know you asked the question about that, but I didn't have really any problems with bird droppings, if that's what you're referring to. I'm not referring to, but
some athletes in previous interviews had mentioned that they were victims of that.
Okay.
So, in your opinion, what was the most meaningful part of these games?
Just the overall games was, I think, just the carnival atmosphere and the absolute success of the U.S. team, the total dominance, and the carnival atmosphere, and how well U.S. athletes were treated. It's kind of interesting, but it didn't matter who you were. If you were from the U.S., they would get your signature. You know, I mean, people would come up and ask for your signature. And it's simple things like even a USA T-shirt, which I look back, I kind of said, well, I don't want to trade my USA T-shirt away. But the USA T-shirt, I could have really gotten some great things with the USA T-shirt. But you look at it today and you go, my God, these things are a dime a dozen. I mean, back then, athletes really treasured a USA T-shirt, and they would trade big time for just that, anything U.S. So we were treated really royally, and didn't matter who we were. I didn't win any medal or anything, but, you know, people would come up and they want my signature, and it was a great experience from that perspective.
Why was the U.S. treated that way?
Just because we were so successful, there were so many gold medalists, the team was just ran away with pretty much, you know, the lion's share of the medals, and there were so many world-class athletes from the U.S. on the team, and it just that's the way it was.
So what does this preservation, this whole project archiving memories of athletes from the 1968 games mean to you?
Well, it means to me that you're going to preserve the legacy. To me, it represented, I think, a major turning point in Olympic history. From a U.S. perspective, the U.S. was so successful, and in subsequent games in 72 and so on in 76, the U.S. was less successful. It was a turning point from protests, because protests started in the games, but the protests became much more serious in later games. I mean, the Palestinian protests where people died. You had in the Chinese Olympic games recently where people were protesting against the government, and there was some suppression, and people were jailed prior to the games. And so it kind of was like a turning point where they started to protest, but the protests were kind of tolerated but not tolerated. People really didn't appreciate that. But now protests became serious, security became serious. The integrity of the games back in 68, there were tests for, chromosome tests for athletes, people that would be feeding, make sure that you had a male or a female. The cheating was a little bit, but the cheating became much more prevalent later on, and you saw this in 72 with the East Europeans with the drug enhancement stuff. So we took drug tests, but it wasn't really major. It was just sort of a minor test, but that now became much more sophisticated after these games. So it was kind of like a turning point. Some of the things were exposed, but they became major issues later on. And drug testing, security, protests, from a U.S. perspective, the quality and the number of medals that were won and the dominance of U.S. was a turning point for that. So there were a lot of aspects of that, and also Mexico, as a very poor country, was able to pull off the games. That was kind of an achievement.
What was it like coming home after the games to see friends, family, and the media, and things like that?
It was wonderful. It was a great experience. I can't talk or speak to somebody who came back with an Olympic medal, so I didn't really get an Olympic medal, so I can't. The people that got Olympic medals can speak to that, how they were treated. But for me, being an Olympian did help me. I mean, I was approached at one point to do some advertising for Schlick for Electric Shave. And unfortunately, I never went to the ad, even though they invited me to go to Chicago for that, because money would have been paid to me, and the Olympic Committee for Fencing said, you can't do that, you lose your amateur status. At that point, though, it's kind of interesting that from 68 on forward, athletes began funneling, sponsorships and things through their Olympic committee, and the money would then come back to them in the form of expenses. So you started to see more and more of that. It was prevalent in 68 for the Winter Games and so on and so forth, where athletes were given pretty hefty expenses for skiing and so on and so forth. So it then became much more widespread, and sports federations now start to give their athletes dollar amounts for winning events.
Right.
And so, it's starting to become pretty serious in terms of financial, because people now get a lot more money today There's a fencer today that has a pretty hefty expense from Nike and so on and so forth because she's a gold medalist and so on and so forth. So back then it wasn't that much, but I didn't experience that in fencing as much, but that was going on in some other sports. But from 68 on, it really became much more prevalent.
Are you involved at all with the fencing team today?
No, not really. I mean, in 68, I ended up going, it's kind of interesting, I ended up going to Vietnam. I had my orders cut when I was at the pentathlon, and I spent a year in Vietnam. And when I came back, I pursued a master's degree and continued fencing and went to some world tournaments. I went to the World University Games, the World Championships. I went to the Pan American Games, and I won a gold medal in team foil. So I did compete, continue to compete after the event. Hopefully that answers your question.
Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, today, I assume the U.S. has a fencing team that competes in the Olympics.
I don't know if you had a role. After that, I did. What I'm saying, I did compete for, 6 or 7 years, and then I stopped fencing. And one of the things that's difficult is trying to make a living and raise a family and fence at the same time. So it sort of took me out, basically. When I got to be about 29 or 30 years old, I stopped fencing. And I picked it up a couple of years ago. I went to Davis, California, and did an event for an old friend of mine and won the event in California. It was an open tournament, so... But generally, I don't fence. Mm-hmm. I'm not active. I mean, some people do carry it forward, and they have really terrific programs for seniors now, where you have 50 and older, 60 and older, and even have 70 and older, and you can continue competing. But it's a lot of expense and money, and I'm not sure if the trade-off is all that worth it. Mm-hmm. If I fence just for recreation and keep myself in shape.
And so now what do you do? Tom mentioned that you work for HP.
Yes, I work for HP, Hewlett-Packard, in a business area, business consulting kind of position. I'm presently assigned now to an account to the state of Ohio in Columbus, so I work there. I've been with the company now 25 years, so I'm getting very close to retirement, and I've got to make a decision this year as to whether I'm going to retire. I am 66, so mm-hmm. I do qualify for full retirement.
Well, I think that's really all the questions I have. Was there something that I left out that you think should be included?
No, I think you captured it. That's quite well. I think the most important thing for you to pick up, I think, and maybe when in this interview and in other interviews, is the 68 Games was kind of a turning point for security, because there was really little, if any, security back in 68. There was security, but not to the extent that we have today. The budgets for the Games were significantly less back then. The performance of the U.S. team was dominant back in 68, so that took a turn. The drug-enhancing stuff, all of that stuff all adds up to, I think, a major turning point. I think some of it was prevalent in 68, but it became much more prevalent as years went by. And games are very, very expensive now, and the security is high and so on and so forth. And it's a little bit different. I should say it's a lot different than it was back then. So, but this is kind of a turning point. So it's definitely worth it for you guys to capture this change. You know, it would be the Olympics a change and is sort of a turning point in Olympic history.
Well,
look at it that way.
Yeah, for sure. Well, thank you so much for all of your insight and stories. I really appreciate it.
Okay, no problem.
And so, yeah, I guess we'll get back to you if we have any more questions.
Sure,
and
no
again,
problem.
Appreciate
thank
it. Thank you.
Okay, bye-bye.
Bye.